Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
They send people down to the deepest recesses of the human mind, and they come back with stories that would literally blow your mind. They're instantly dismissed. They're technically marked down as insane.
Alan Pierce is co-author, along with his wife Beverly, of a new book that explores the beautiful, disturbing, and dangerous world in coma. Journalist, broadcaster, author, also specializing in foreign affairs and cybersecurity, he's also written several other books. Here's some basic stats on coma. According to the Cleveland Clinic, there are more than 250 new comas per 100,000 people in the United States and the United Kingdom every year. A coma doesn't usually last longer than a few weeks. During this time, the person may start to gradually wake up and gain consciousness. However, only 15% of patients in established medical coma for 6 hours will make a good or moderate recovery. Others will die, 61%, remain vegetative, 12%, or become permanently dependent on others for daily living, 11%. What happens during a coma? That's new territory. And that's what we're going to explore. This is groundbreaking research that offers insight into the need to change the way coma patients are treated. Coma and the Near-Death Experience, A Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. Author, I'm talking with Alan Pierce, and this is an incredible, I think COVID gave us a gift. No matter what anybody says, it's awful, it's no, I don't wish it on anybody, but what we are learning from people who are put into deep comas, I think this will be life-changing going forward in the way that we treat people who are in the position where they may be put into a coma and it isn't necessarily in their best interest. So, Alan, you have an amazing book. I really appreciate what you've done. Can you tell us how it started for you and what you hope to achieve?
You say COVID. COVID is key to this in so many ways. You know, we had no intention of writing a book. COVID happens. I think it was just early lockdown. My wife, B, and I suddenly didn't have a lot to do. And I was watching the evening news, and I'm a journalist, so I have this tendency to keep asking more questions. So there are people constantly being placed into medically induced comas with COVID. And I just wanted to know how, why, well, how does that work? And I set out to find out. And also wondered what, if anything, they might experience inside their coma, given that doctors refer to it as sleep. First stop, I think, was Google. So, you know, what's the point of a medically induced coma? How does it work? The standard answer is that a medically induced coma gives a seriously sick patient the best fighting chance. It gives them the deepest restorative form of sleep. They also say that it should be a blank in their lives. Well, that's what Google said. And I just wanted to know more. So after a bit of time, because I had a fair bit of time on my hands, I joined the Coma Survivors Group on Facebook. They allowed me not to post, but to sit in the margins and just watch. And far from being a blank, people were recounting the most incredible events within coma. They ranged from horrendous, nightmarish events, some of which involving the hospital staff trying to murder them, torture them. Others were exceptionally beautiful, very much like a near-death experience. And then there was another type where people were experiencing an alternate life. When I say experiencing, I mean minute by minute, as if we were actually having another life. And I looked everywhere, and I couldn't see any parallels. But the other thing that really got me was that everybody on the forum were also listing a whole bunch of physical complaints, and they were all remarkably similar, from loss of memory, extreme aches and pains, balance, inability to sleep. And it seemed that here is a group of people that are all experiencing things that the doctors don't appear to know anything about. And I just knew we had a story, and I just began from there.
The amazing thing that I learned
is that there are really beneficial qualities to sleep in terms of helping the brain recover. And in coma, these kinds of deep coma, you don't have that REM sleep. And I was astounded. I thought, well, that makes no sense that this is considered a restorative procedure when you're basically eradicating any potential for REM sleep. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, so true. The word coma comes from the Greek word, a Greek word, meaning deep sleep. So everyone refers to it as sleep. When they're putting someone down into a coma, they will say, time now for a deep sleep, and so on. It's a bit like having a desktop computer and unplugging it from the electrical socket and expecting it to work in any way. The brain will not function when it's switched off. Coma comes in all sorts of levels. It's very, very hard to say what level anybody is at. They could be bubbling beneath the surface, or they could be so low that they are touching death. And the things that will happen to them at these different levels are beyond remarkable. I'm going off on a tangent, as I always will with this book, and I've now forgotten your original question, Wendy.
I don't care about whether you're going off on a tangent. You're the one who knows this story backwards and forwards. The thing that I was asking about the REM sleep and not being able to get that kind of sleep to help the brain repair itself.
Exactly. So your brain is switched off. You do not have the luxury of going through your circadian rhythms. If you don't do that, you're not having REM sleep. You're not dreaming or sleeping in any shape, manner, or form. Just 3 days of sleep deprivation can drive people completely over the edge. It's fair to say that many people in hospital, particularly those in intensive care, not within a coma, are just not getting their 6 to 8 hours of sleep a day. They're getting a tiny amount of sleep, and they are becoming sleep deprived. And therefore, this brings on a whole bunch of effects, which are generally classified as ICU delirium. When you put somebody down into a coma, there's nowhere they're dreaming. There's nowhere they're having nightmares. And yet the doctors will refer to events within coma as coma dreams, hallucinations, and delirium. Hallucinations and delirium are conscious states. Hallucinating, for example, is invariably done with the eyes open. So they've got no understanding. And when they send people down to the deepest recesses of the human mind, and they come back with stories that would literally blow your mind, they're instantly dismissed. They're technically marked down as insane. And in many cases, no one's even listening anyway. So doctors don't even know what's happening to these patients. The patients come away from all of this. They've experienced the most remarkable events within their coma. They think they're on their own. They think they've gone mad. And the book, one of the aims of the book, is to bring an end to prolonged deep sedation when it's unnecessary. And the other is to show coma survivors that they are not suffering alone.
One of the things I thought was so powerful was the nurse who had not, in her experience, been able to follow somebody from start to finish. She wasn't able to build a relationship. And some of it was because it's pretty traumatic when you're dealing with somebody who may not survive. But she was able to track a survivor from going into ICU and being deeply sedated and coming out and going home, and then realizing that what they had done by putting the patient in a coma really was disastrous, to say, you know, say the least. You know which one I'm talking about?
Oh, absolutely. This is Polly Bailey, who's a legend in intensive care, in the enlightened part of intensive care. She's almost written the book, as it were, or she certainly contributed to the books that now give a clear understanding of that prolonged deep sedation is not only exceptionally dangerous, it actually kills people, either at the time within the hospital, within the coma, or soon after discharge. And it was basically Polly Bailey in the modern world waking up to this. She followed a patient home from hospital because she became friendly with the family because they came from the same small town. And she couldn't believe what she was seeing. And cut a long story short, she convinced her doctor that we are causing so much damage. And he said, think of another way of doing this. And she just wrote the book off scratch. And it boils down to this in a nutshell. You do not need to sedate people to coma levels for hardly any of the things that they do today. COVID, they put people in comas. If someone's having a brain seizure, yes. If they've got certain injuries, such as abdominal, and if they're recovering from certain types of heart operation, there are complications. Other than that, you do not need to put anyone in a coma. The argument goes that anybody on a mechanical ventilator cannot tolerate being conscious. They cannot tolerate having this giant tube down their throat. They will fight the vent, so they knock them out. Almost all doctors and nurses believe this. With COVID, it just got so much worse because everyone was so overwhelmed. Staff got burnt out. It was decided almost universally that the best thing you could do was just render all your patients senseless, turn them every 2 hours, and hope for the best. And now we're stuck in this. But people like Polly Bailey had introduced a whole new way of thinking. And it was starting to spread around the world, just slowly, but slowly started to spread. And then COVID hit and just went back to the really bad old practices of the 90s and 80s, where you just knock them out.
Well, I think that's because that's what had been done, and there weren't those mass numbers of patients coming in until COVID, that all of a sudden hospitals were overwhelmed, and they didn't have time to research a best practice. All they were trying to do was basically stay afloat.
Oh, precisely. And so many of the experienced staff working in intensive care units around the world, including many that were waking up to the notion that you do not need to deeply sedate people, the sheer workload burnt them out. And, you know, I quote in the book some numbers of the nursing staff who just resigned because of stress and breakdown, substance abuse, suicidal thoughts, all the rest of it. So the people that came in to fill their shoes had no understanding of intensive care. They came from pediatrics, they came from surgical ICUs or whatever, but they didn't understand how to deal with somebody, say, who has deep pneumonia, which resembles in some respects COVID. They had no idea, and they just thought, best thing to do, knock them out.
The one thing you do have on YouTube, Coma and Near-Death Experience, this is a channel on YouTube, alanpierce.com is a website for the book Coma. The experiencers share what they had to go through. Deborah, is that the one who was alive for 80 years by her time?
When people ask Deborah, how long were you in a coma? She answers, yes, 80 years. Do you want to tell us a bit about the story? Because it is a strange one.
That was bizarre. I would have never expected anything like that.
And here's the thing. It's no stranger than any of the other accounts from within coma that I've gathered. All the stories I've gathered from within coma that have been told to me personally are off the scale in terms of human imagination. And there's no way any Hollywood scriptwriter could come up with anything as crazy or as horrifying unless they'd interviewed coma survivors beforehand. Debbie's experience was just truly ghastly. I mean, do you want me to go into that one?
Yeah, how long was she actually in the coma?
I think it was around 2 months that she was placed in the coma, and she had pneumonia. No, she had COVID, but it wasn't at that time diagnosed. It was very early on in the pandemic. Doctors basically said, said to her husband, you know, she's unlikely to survive the night, so we're going to have to place her into a medically induced coma. Down she went, but it's not always an immediate switch off, like there you are in this reality in the hospital, click, there you are in coma. Often you're sliding down, and the events around you within the hospital weave themselves into this alternate reality. And in this reality, one of the nurses who was working on the ward said to Deborah, would you like a job? Would you like to earn your keep, seeing that you're just sitting there, lying there, doing nothing? I'm opening a bar. She says, it's a serial killer-themed bar, and we need people to lie still. That's pretty odd. Mm-hmm. Deborah then finds herself paralyzed in this bar. It's called the old airport. They sell all manner of drinks and so on. There's a paying audience. And nightly, initially they employed actors. Actors would come in and reenact certain serial crimes or Jack the Ripper type events on Deborah in front of a paying audience. This became so successful that they started hiring people released from prison, sex offenders, rapists, in some cases murderers. And they carried out their sex crimes and murders on Deborah every night for 80 years. during that time, she fell pregnant 3 times, gave birth 3 times. I mean, I find it hard to gauge time in this life, so it's hard to say how Deborah did in that one, but she had certain landmarks, like the change of management, the hiring of these actual sex killers. And then eventually the bar had to close, so they didn't know what to do with her. So what they did was put her in a wheelchair, take her off to an organ harvesting facility, where I imagine she was sold, and she was placed into a water tank where she just watched her body dissolve. Now, Deborah comes out of that, and she's not the same person again. She's very lucky that she managed to connect by Facebook with other coma survivors, because so many do not. And when you have an experience like that, it's not like a dream. It's not like a nightmare. It is as real as this. And it's very much like when you talk to people who've experienced an NDE, the near-death experience, they will often say it was more real than reality. And that's what coma survivors report. Every single one of them has mentioned that in one way or another to me.
Well, and these stories are just amazing, because in some cases, these alternate realities are very similar. So it would be hard to know if you're dreaming, you're awake. And I can see where if they are not allowing relatives to visit you or any kind of physical contact, and you're just under for 2 months, how you would disconnect. You would have no idea that the real world still existed.
You're in the deepest form of sensory deprivation. And we know from lots of scientific experiments with sensory dep that, supposing they put you in a dark room for 15 minutes, 15, and there's no light, there's no sound, there's nothing. There's virtually nothing to touch either, say in a comfy chair. Within 15 minutes, you will start to see beautiful geometric patterns in your mind's eye. There's a thing known as the prisoner's cinema. Prisoners placed in solitary confinement report initially these visuals, but then they turn into other things. They find themselves in other realities over time. They find their soul full of other people. And the same thing appears to be happening to people, certainly in the lighter levels of coma, and certainly amongst people who are not even deeply sedated within intensive care, because the lack of stimulation, mental, physical, visual, allows the mind somehow, and this is not understood, allows the mind to somehow create images. And that's certainly happening at one stage. I think when some people are experiencing their alternate lives, not so much Debbie's one with hope, but others are just lives much like our own. For example, you know, I've spoken to people that have had all the trappings of our lives within coma, in that they've held down jobs, got married, gone on vacation, had kids, worried about what we're going to have for dinner tonight, that level of existence. And that is so strange. And when you come out of that, for example, when you come out of that and you open your eyes, for a long time, you can't speak if you've been on a mechanical ventilator because of damage to your vocal cords. So you can't communicate. Often when people come out of a coma, they say, I don't recognize who these people are. Often people certainly don't recognize their relatives. So you might come out of a coma and there's your partner wishing you, how are you, and trying to hold your hand and talk to you. And you haven't got the first clue who that person is. As far as you're concerned, this is a completely different life, and you've just suddenly left your life behind. And it takes a lot of convincing that, to tell these people that they're not now in their coma, and that what they experienced before was within their coma. It is extraordinarily difficult for them to get a grip, because you know, they've done things within their coma, just like us. They can taste and smell and just do everything, the pain, the joy, everything within their coma. I cannot find a parallel to that sort of thing anywhere. And where the case of Deborah, that lasted 80 years as such, Nick could clearly span his life over a 20-year period from the 1960s to the 1970s. He even got called up to serve in Southeast Asia and did a combat tour there. And that level of detail. And to come back to this world and be told, I'm sorry, that's just an hallucination or a false memory, really makes you think she got mad.
Well, and it's so traumatizing, because if they liked that realm that they were in, then the loss, the grief is still going to be very real.
I've spoke to a lot of coma survivors, many of whom are not in the book. There were two men in particular who had alternate lives, married lives, and they wanted to tell me about them, at least they thought they did. And as we sat down to talk, I mean, certainly the first one just broke down into tears and just could not. The grief he felt, the loss and love in his children, they're just gone. You know, his wife is just gone, all his friends, everything, just gone. And he was in therapy. But what kind of therapy can you give somebody for this other than saying, I'm sorry, pal, that was a false memory. We've got some great medication. People need to talk to other coma survivors. But because the events in this book are just not generally known, people don't even know that they can talk to other coma survivors, and we do show them how.
I think that's why this book is so important, because for others who experience transcendence, alternate realities, near-death experience, after-death issues are, there's still something we're just beginning to get into and realize that this is not an anomaly. This is part of our normal. We just haven't done the research that says for everyone who wants to have it proved by certain standards that it is real. And that's where it gets dicey, because there are certain kinds of experiments we run that we consider proof and others somehow don't fit us, especially if they're experiential. It's like, okay, no, you didn't experience it because we can't prove it and neither can you. Well, that doesn't make it go away.
Science has got stuck. You know, you go back to, I don't know, the days of King Solomon, just to pick a date out of my head. People understood these things then. People knew of the near-death experience and saw it as a mystical experience. Fast forward to what we call the Enlightenment and the days of Isaac Newton and the apple falling from the tree. Science became materialistic, as in, if you can't weigh it, see it, or measure it, it doesn't exist. And when you come to the question of consciousness, because you can't do any of those things, the tendency is to ignore it. And we've been stuck like that. So when a doctor or a scientist, up until this sort of period, is presented with an event, say within coma, they just quickly dismiss it as a form of mental illness, or possibly a blip. You know, ICU delirium sounds like the sort of thing that'll wear off as soon as you get home. But it doesn't. It stays with people. It's not understood. We need now to move forward, leave that kind of science behind, and start exploring these realms. It's more and more important as we're trying to understand artificial intelligence, it's first stopping and trying to examine our own.
Carl Jung, when he actually had an experience that changed, that shifted him, then they all of a sudden he lost some of his credibility, because that isn't real, that isn't possible. And I think, my gosh, here's one of the people that we admire, we respect for all of the information that he has provided in terms of psychology. Then all of a sudden, when he has a transcendent experience and says, hey, there's more out here, it's like, no, you went too far.
It's as if he himself had caught, you know, some mental illness from all his patients. That's certainly how this was perceived. It is curious. When Carl Jung wrote up his experiences within coma, he was able to view the Earth from above. And when you look at his description and you compare that to a modern-day NASA photograph, he's seeing the same image, but no one in his lifetime had ever seen a picture of Earth from space. He could see the Himalayas. He could see the Sahara Desert, and so on and so forth. How would he even possibly have known that? And he understood at that moment that he had tapped into something far greater, this collective consciousness, in which we all have it. It's all part of us, but we don't connect to it because it is part of our unconsciousness, but it helps make up who we are. That's more or less in a nutshell as he perceived it.
Well, some of the stuff that I am reading about in your book, to me, it fits so easily within shamanic studies, with studies with more of a metaphysical aspect, because it addresses issues that people who've had out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, have just tried to describe and say, this is what it's like. Why is it so difficult to make that jump?
Well, it's so remarkable that you point to that, because we try to find parallels to the events within coma. And one place we looked was the Amazon, and we didn't get to go because of lockdown. But we spoke to a lot of people that have partaken of the Amazonian mystic brew, ayahuasca, the key ingredient of which is a compound, psychedelic compound, DMT. The events that they describe within an ayahuasca journey clearly resemble those within coma. And it's worth noting that the human body produces its own DMT. No one can tell you why we produce it. They can't even tell us where, but they can find it within our systems. And it is worth noting that people suffering from schizophrenia often have high levels of DMT in their urine. And effectively, when you're in the Amazon drinking this potion, or when you're in a coma, and certain elements within the brain switch off, and this naturally occurring drug takes over, you are, in a sense, having a form of psychedelic trip. But it's not drugs, as it were. It's more like a key opening a doorway.
I remember a story. I interviewed somebody a while back, and it had to do with the ayahuasca. It triggered a memory for him of a past life, and he was able to actually go back and connect the dots to ascertain that this happened. It was real. It's a part of his soul history, however you want to term that. Are these experiences also similar for other people who get into coma, that they're connecting into these altered states, that they can go back and actually connect the dots to make them real? Is that possible?
Oh, yeah. No two events are ever the same. But the events that people recount having taken ayahuasca, people who've taken part in DMT scientific trials, people that do DMT as a recreational drug, and people in coma, all experiencing events within the same ballpark. Initially, certainly with ayahuasca, if you're not careful, you're into a nightmarish world. But you're prepped for this because you're told that Mother Ayahuasca can play some nasty tricks on you, and be prepared for this. So you tend to be. Often, you're going into your journey with a shaman who's actually with you. Now, that helps you put everything into perspective and helps cushion you for some of the things you're about to see. If you're experiencing the same level of DMT within a coma and it's occurring naturally and no one has prepped you, and no one will debrief you at the other end, you truly think you've gone mad. Mm. And I spoke to a number of people that have done DMT in different forms, and I put it to them, how would you imagine it would have felt for you first time round if no one had explained it to you? They just dropped it in your coffee safe. They all, without fail, had said, I would have gone mad. That's how I would have seen myself. And that's what coma survivors tell me. Intensive care has become a conveyor belt of care. It's not why anybody entered nursing. And it's a vibrant, busy, noisy place. And you find yourself on a gurney and you push into a slot. And next thing you know, they are beginning to sedate you because you're going to get agitated just because of your environment. Rarely, and I never heard of that, would they ever say to anybody, oh, incidentally, you're going to have some funny events within your coma, because they would say to the family that person, your loved one within that coma, won't remember anything. It's a complete blank. It'll be just like I flicked off a switch and we've switched it back on. It will be a complete blank in their lives, mercifully. And it isn't. It most certainly isn't. And when people eventually talk about it, they're dismissed. And if they get to talk to their families or somebody down the line, and they try and talk to them about an alternate life and other children that they've had, people will think or say aloud even, look, dear, you've been until recently up to the eyeballs, drugged up to the eyeballs. What do you expect? And that's how it's left. It's left like that.
There needs to be more information about the potential for the after effects. But I think a lot of that, there's a disconnect. There isn't that one-on-one, hands-on experience that we would have experienced as part of an indigenous community where you aren't isolated. I guess I'm botching that, but the isolation, I think, is what's a killer.
Absolutely, and it's become worse because of COVID. COVID is so key to all of this. Even if you weren't in a coma, the fact that no one could visit you and all the rest of it all adds to this deterioration in your mental welfare. It's just so not understood. No doctor understands this because, quite frankly, the vast majority have not brought themselves up to speed on all the remarkable literature and research that's come out of COVID at the back of the book, I wouldn't expect everyone to read all this, but there are in fact 20 pages just listing all the medical and scientific papers that we use to back up everything that we say in this book. If a doctor or a nurse who says you cannot be on a mechanical ventilator and be conscious, if a person like that were to read half of the notes at the back of the book, they would have an education and would know that they have to change, because it's been clearly demonstrated that the longer you stay into a coma, appalling damage will occur. We've talked to the sleep deprivation that will cause acute brain failure. They used to think that bed rest was the best thing. It's been that way for thousands of years. It turns out that just 1 week of bed rest can result in the loss of 10% of lean muscle. 10% in 1 week. People in a coma often have for 2 or 3 months. The only exercise they get is a nurse flipping them over every 2 hours. The damage that is caused, nerves disconnect, joints calcify, and there are shocking holes in the memory that the muscle loss is never apparent because they're so pumped full of fluids that they look all puffy. Often you can carry about 50 pounds in weight in excess fluid, and yet your muscles have all wasted away. So it's not immediately apparent. And also, the people within the intensive care unit, because it's a conveyor belt of care, do not get to look over their shoulder at the product coming off the other end. They do not see the damage that has been caused. And everybody, the majority of people I have spoken to, have had zero explanation of what's happened to them physically or mentally. And when they have, they're told things like, what is a false memory? There's some great medication for that. And that's all.
The book Coma and Near-Death Experience. Alan's website, alanpierce.com. A quick break.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Coma and Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. On the back of the book, from Peter J. Murphy, MD, Professor and Chief of Medicine at California North State University College of Medicine. These amazing insights into ICU delirium, coma, and sleep are critically important to the human condition. I'm talking with Alan Pierce. Website, alanpierce.com.
Do you have any insight into potential changes for this procedure, if it's going to improve the way that people treat coma patients?
Yeah, because of COVID, because of the sheer scale, the sheer number of people globally that were placed into comas, that you can now see the damage far more clearly. A lot of people are waking up to it. I think it's going to take time, because let's supposing you've been an ICU nurse for the past 30 years. You've done with the best of intentions what you've always done, and you haven't seen the damage. So you're going to rail against some policy that says, oh no, keep them awake, keep other tubes down their throat, and get them walking around. They're going to think that's absolutely insane. And people do say, and have said to me, that is absolutely insane. But there are hospitals, certainly pre-COVID, many throughout COVID, carried on with their original practices of talking to people before you put them on a ventilator and saying, look, this is the best kit that there is. We're just going to get you to sleep for about 20 minutes or so. When you wake up, it's going to feel uncomfortable. We'll give you something for that. And they do this. And when the person comes to, ideally you've got a relative beside them who's holding their hand, who's keeping them calm. And within a few minutes, they get used to it. Now, I've watched, because we couldn't get to go because of COVID lockdown, I've watched videos of patients sitting upright in bed on a mechanical ventilator, running a business on their laptop. I've seen people cracking jokes on a whiteboard with the hospital staff. And I saw from Brazil, patients on mobile mechanical ventilators playing volleyball in an intensive care unit. This is the way to go. It is not to keep people senseless in bed where they resemble sacks of potatoes. Is to have them conscious and have them invested in their own recovery.
See, that's, I think, incredibly important. We are social. There's studies that say that this is something we require. And one of the biggest problems right now is loneliness. So to induce something like that with extreme, I would call it, isolation, then that's kind of a death sentence.
It literally is a death sentence for so many. Because the word coma, I mean, we're using coma. Some doctors will say coma. More often than not, they would just simply talk of sedation. Not say how much, just talk of sedation. So it sounds like a kind of gentle sort of thing that a person might have just to relieve anxiety. So it's hard to say how many people in any given period have been placed into medically induced comas. But we know, because of COVID, that around about 80% of people globally who found themselves in intensive care units, who found themselves on a mechanical ventilator, were deeply sedated to coma levels. So this is really affecting millions of people around the world. A lot of people died within coma. I think families might like to know what that may have been like for them, because it's not all hell. Often it can be exceptionally beautiful. And even those who are experiencing hell within their coma, many a time will move on to something exceptionally beautiful at the end, like a classic near-death experience.
Well, some of the
don't understand...
Go ahead.
Go on, no, carry on.
I was going to say, some of the people
please
describe like an LSD experience.
Because if you look at how LSD works, when you put somebody into an MRI scanner, give them LSD or psilocybin or other psychedelic drugs, instead of the brain being suddenly active and lighting up like a Christmas tree, it quietens down. They find that blood flow to certain parts of the brain just almost stop, just enough to keep it ticking over. And it's just the fact that certain elements switch off within your brain that leads to an expansion of consciousness. They've looked at monks who are deep into transcendental meditation and wired them up to an EEG brain scanner. And it's almost like a flat line. They've wired up people who've taken psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. And again, the same effect. And they can tell within coma, certainly by working on patients who have had a spontaneous coma, let's say, that they're having the same effects within coma as everybody else is having who experiences DMT. And for sure, they are effectively tripping, because the mind has, the filter has come off the mind. It allows the mind to expand, and they see the things that people do see on certain forms of psychedelics. It varies from the psychedelic to psychedelic. But what does happen is the brain shuts down or quietens down considerably, as it does within coma, if not fully, if you're in the deeper states.
All of these experiences that you touch on, from the horrific to the exceptional, there's just so much to learn from in this that says we're more than the physical body. And some of this consciousness stuff really begs attention before we put this kind of trauma on somebody by saying, well, this is the best that we can do, so we're going to knock you out, and then, you know, you may or may not recover.
Yeah, I mean, I just want that to stop. That's the thing. Now, for example, having done the research, having written the book, if any loved one of mine was in the hospital and I thought there was the faintest hint that they would be placed into a medically induced coma, I would be on the case immediately. If I were younger, I'd very likely have a tattoo on my chest saying no coma, because it really, really shouldn't happen, except in a handful of cases. But it's used, massively overused, simply because often they think this person is going to die. If we can shut down the body and the mind, we will slow down that dying process, and maybe in the interim, the drugs and nature will have a chance. So they just do that. And so there's nothing to back it up. We spoke to the editors of the medical journal, The Lancet, and we said, can you point us to any articles advocating prolonged deep sedation in intensive care? And they thought about it and came back and said, no, we've never published one. So they said, would you like access to our archives? So my wife, Bea, who's a former private investigator, and I plow through the archives. And there's nothing in there. There's nothing in there advocating prolonged deep sedation outside of brain seizures, certain wounds, and certain complications after heart surgery. That's it. And no one seems to know this. And there are a group of doctors and nurses who are getting so much stick within their profession, trying to wake people up to it. But the key thing is, I started to say this earlier, if you've been an ICU nurse for 30 years, it's unlikely they'll make you change. New people entering the profession, and this strikes me as really impressive. Since COVID, more and more young people are training to be doctors and nurses, certainly in the USA, and I've heard similar accounts in the UK. Now, these people will come in, they will read the current up-to-date papers, not just do what their supervisor has always told everyone to do, and they will be alert to these dangers. One of the people who's been helping us with the book is Jill Larkin-Storer. She's a nurse practitioner down in Maryland, and she trains nurses for critical care. She has now added our book to their curriculum so nurses can see what people are experiencing inside coma and that these are not false memories, ICU delirium, or hallucinations. There's something that need taking seriously and in many ways thoroughly avoiding, and to keep patients active, keep their brain active, keep their body active. If you can make them physically tired in a hospital environment, as in walking around on a frame or whatever for a little bit, they will get proper restorative sleep. But when you're in a coma, you've just blanked everyone out. Nothing is working. Your kidneys don't function. They're not going through the 24-hour cycle. Nothing is functioning. And you're just in stasis, like you're in a sci-fi movie.
When you were talking about the information that you have in your book, I wanted to include this. It took me a minute to find it. The coronary artery bypass grafts, CABG. And this is one of the most common surgical procedures. This is just like the tip of the iceberg for the research, because you're only putting them out under general anesthesia for 3 to 6 hours. And you quote the research in here that says how much damage that does, just that little bit of disconnect in order to help somebody heal. But that's huge.
Yeah. Oh, it's scary. It's more or less the same drugs used in surgery that they use in coma. It depends on availability and where you are in the world. The thing is, an awful lot of people who come out of prolonged deep anesthesia in surgery, they're having tense points wiped off their IQ. But these are hospital-acquired conditions. They're not invariably not covered by insurance. So no one wants to talk about them. And it's like, oh, fine, yes, of course. Everyone gets a bit vague when they come out of it. Don't you worry, everything will come back. And people assume it will. And then when it doesn't, they think it's just them. Oh, I must be getting early onset dementia or something. And they found, it's a terrible one. Dr. Wes Ely, who's professor of medicine at Vanderbilt Medical School, he realized that there was massive damage being caused to people within coma. And he took one coma survivor who had been a mathematical whiz. I think she had a ridiculously high IQ of 140. After her coma, she couldn't even add up her checking account. And she got to take another IQ test. She came in at 100, which is effectively teetering on subnormal. But when they looked at her brain within an MRI scanner, elements of her brain had actually shrunk within her coma. And instead of having the brain of a 35-year-old woman, she had the brain of an old woman with dementia. And that was from being in a coma, I can't think exactly, but 5 weeks or thereabouts.
And see, the comp that I was looking at, the research from the people who had the coronary artery, I can't even do that, I'm going to mess it up, the CABG.
Are you doing the audio book? Poor loving from that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So this is the research that said 80 to 90% of the patients had symptoms of confusion, diminished concentration, loss of short-term memory, and word and face recognition loss. This is that's how crucial this is when we are disconnected from our own body in order to heal or create a healing environment. It's really scary.
It is, and you'll notice more and more that less are they placing people into giving them general anaesthetic if there's a way of doing it with a local. Whereas in the past, it would be the simplest thing, is knock them out, do whatever we've got to do, bring them round. Now they try and avoid that because they are, amongst themselves, aware of damage that's being caused. But because they can't say, oh, I'm sorry, yes, I'm sorry, we've wiped all those points off your IQ. They just have to simply say, don't worry about it. It will pass. And it doesn't. And people are left with, I can't say specifically for the 4 hour to 6 hour, but I spoke to a nurse who both her parents had the operation. She's in the book. And that worked in cardiac surgery. She says it's commonplace, but we don't want to talk about it.
Like 5 years for recovery, if you've got recovery, 5 years. And I interrupted you. So she says...
No. Yeah, go on. So sorry. Yes, go on.
I just wanted a time frame for this, because when you're looking at somebody who's going to go through that kind of procedure and then realizing these are the contraindications, these are the side effects after you've done this procedure, then you, at least if you know that's a potential and that maybe you can address it without going so deeply or for any length of time into that altered state, then maybe you can help reduce some of the damage.
Yeah, I think two doctors in the book use the word ignorance, as in everything is done with the very best of intentions. No one has any aim to harm a patient ever, and they want the best outcome for everyone ever. However, no one's really running at their full potential, because everyone is worn out, everyone's too tired, everyone's overworked, particularly within an intensive care unit. The emotional strain of losing so many patients really wears you down. It is a case of ignorance, because everyone's so busy doing what they do, they don't see what happens next when that person gets pushed down the line to a care facility. When eventually they leave that care facility, when they get home, they find that all sorts of problems. They can't remember the children's names. They spend 2 hours in the shower because they can't figure it out. They struggle to get a fork into their mouth. They are the shadows of their former selves, and they become reclusive. They do many times, if they've had these terrible experiences within coma, they do not want to go to sleep at night, because these dreams, these come back as dreams. And they're sharper, more lucid than normal dreams as a consequence of having been down there. So they don't want to go to sleep, or they knock themselves out with drugs of one kind or another. But that doesn't always work. So if anything, people are dozing a bit throughout the day when there's other people around, and it feels more comforting as staying up all night. And this has a terrible effect on them. It's just one element. The damage that's being caused, and we talked earlier, the nurse Polly Bailey, she's one person, so extremely rare that she followed a patient home that we could actually give a date when this thing happened. And we've spoken to other doctors, and doctors in particular, who have put their hands up and said, we've been following standard medical procedure, but we know we've killed people. And I've heard others who say, yeah, I know we've caused them all this damage, which is why I now am fighting, says the doctor, to change all this, to wake other people up the way I've woken up. And those that have woken up, unless they've come brand new to this way of treating patients, they have woken up to it. They've traumatized themselves with so much loss within their patient community. When Dr. Wes Ely counted up the number of people under his care in a few years that he believed he had damaged through coma, did you want to give up and become something else entirely?
Yeah. At this point, though, the blame, it's gone. It's water under the bridge. It's thing of, if we know now, then we can counter some of these negative outcomes by beginning with a different practice. I'm so glad that you guys, with your wife being a private investigator, the former private investigator, you guys did a deep dive. This is an intense amount of work that you've done to come up with all the stories, you know, to follow up and get the other aspect with the doctors and with the research that's being done. You've done a wonderful service.
Oh, thank you. But we have actually brought to this journalistic skills, being my wife as a private eye. She did all sorts, but she often worked for newspapers, particularly the Sunday Times, where I worked for a time, not that we worked at the same time. If you make one mistake in a place like that, you're not going to work again. You're so geared up to getting everything right, checking. Then after you've done it all, someone else is checking. And that's actually what happened at the publishers too. I had some of the smartest fact-checking I've experienced since I've been on a national newspaper. So what we've done, we've taken pure journalistic skills, and it is curious. This has been a medical procedure for the past 50 years, and it's taken a journo and a private eye to actually tell the story as it really is, because nobody else was going to tell you.
You know what? I don't think the numbers before would allow this kind of magnitude to, I mean, with these numbers with COVID, you're talking hundreds of thousands of cases global. So this has an immense impact upon the entire planet.
One doctor told me, Dr. Peter Murphy, who's head of medicine at North State University in California, categorically, he believes that if we can bring an end to this level of deep sedation, prolonged deep sedation, over time, there will be millions of lives that are saved. Those that would have died within coma, and those whose lives have just been ruined as a consequence. Those that can't go out anymore, those that can't sleep anymore, those that are so utterly scared of death, lives are ruined. Yeah, and it's like anything, isn't it, really? If you think, you know, for 2,000 years, it was standard medical procedure to drain blood from the people at death's door to balance their humours. They must have killed countless people over the centuries. And yet, somehow, we have got out of that. It's going to be a lot easier getting out of COVID because there's so much research that's been done, brought about by COVID, people waking up to the damage that they're causing, that we can clearly see it, and it's extremely easy to find these papers. The book at the back, incidentally, just contains everything you need to actually pass a serious medical examination in intensive care. But the average reader doesn't even need to go there. You just need to know that everything we say is thoroughly backed up in the literature.
The bibliography has a ton of resources, and I think that's important. You know, this is, and the Facebook groups, you've included the other resources along with Facebook. There's a podcast. If you are listening as a survivor and experiencer, somebody who has part of the story to share, that this would be another way to add to the collective knowing of what's happening as we increase our awareness and improve the standard of care.
So much can be learned. I mean, just simple things. They call it ICU delirium, people going a bit doolally in intensive care. It's because their minds are not occupied. Occupy their minds. Occupy their bodies. And they won't get that. And that's just, like, lesson number one. It's just so easy. And the book shows you how it happens in so many other situations that you can't help but see the parallels within intensive care units. Like calling it sleep. Just think it through. Oh. You switch someone's brain off, they're not going to go through the circadian rhythms. How, therefore, are they sleeping? But they still say sleep. It's like nobody's paying attention.
Yeah, that was the thing that I got when I'm like, that doesn't mean there's no REM sleep. The brain isn't doing its cleaning. This is not good. And like, oh my gosh. And until you read something like this, you just assume, I assume, coma, yeah, sleep. They're just going to put you to sleep. No, it's nothing resembling sleep at all.
No, and also because the brain's not going, you know, not going through the cycles, the kidneys don't do their 24-hour cycle, which means they're not expelling the toxins from the body. They're pumping you full of the most remarkably potent drugs, and they're not being processed by the kidneys. Again, it's extremely difficult to get figures, but I spoke to one Danish doctor who's been doing his own research, and he's demonstrating that because the kidneys are switched off, they become damaged, and an awful lot of people find themselves needing dialysis either within their coma or soon after. And the number of coma survivors that just dropped it into the conversation, oh, and they thought, I might need a kidney transplant, but I bounced straight back when they switched me off. That was also found by this Danish doctor. Switch people off soon enough and the kidneys bounce back. That's just the kidneys. Nothing else is functioning. It's not going through their cycles.
Okay, so you are collecting stories at that comapodcast.com. Is that correct?
What I would like to do is to hear from other coma survivors. I have no intention of writing another book, like a sequel, Coma and the Death Experience 2. That's not going to happen.
I wonder why. Looking at the content of this one, I can see,
I can't believe we've even done it. I've been exhausted just holding it in my hand.
Yeah.
We've done so much work. What we would like to do, though, is find coma survivors who are willing to tell their stories and perhaps collect some form of archive or something like that. On my website, you can get in touch with me. I guarantee I answer every email, not immediately, but I will answer every email, and thoughtfully so. So, Yes, if you want to and feel capable, because it's not always possible, feel capable of telling your story in some form, let me know. Or you just want to share your experiences with me. I'm happy to discuss them and point out some things you might do to kind of help improve your life or find others. I've put people in touch already, but certainly for the Coma Survivors Group on Facebook. If you've been in a coma, they will let you in. And my gosh, you will find some of the kindest, most wonderful, caring people, helpful people there. And they're so willing to share, so willing to share.
Well, and some of the stories are posted at comapodcast.com.
We try to get them to record their own accounts. It never works for different reasons, different people. So we were lucky that we know a number of voice artists, and we've had them recount stories from within the book. And they're just like nothing anyone has ever heard before in their lives. And you might think, oh yeah, really, you know, I think I've heard it all. You have heard nothing like this. Some we've had to put warnings on because you wouldn't want your kids listening to them. Others are just so astoundingly beautiful. It just makes you really, and this is the other thing. When I began this project, I was in no sense spiritual. I didn't even stop to think about it as a subject. Now, if you ask me, I'm 100% spiritual. I've spoken to people who have died and come back. They have been remarkably consistent in their stories. The people that have told me this are not just people I just quickly met online. These are people I spent months talking to, because it takes a long time to draw stories out of some people. And along the way, I've been sharing what we've been discovering with coma survivors. There's 20 or so that fully helped us with the book, and even to the point of reading the early stages of the book and looking for anything that might be wrong, or telling us, but you should look at this. Total involvement in this. So if people do wish to get in touch, I'm not sure what we're going to do with that, but we'll certainly, you know, make note and come back to you. If we do manage to put together an archive and you are capable of actually telling a story, because it's so difficult.
Jeffrey Kripal does the preface of the book and says, please read this book. It's not what you probably think it is. It's not a book about coma and sedation and why we should think twice about this. Not only a book about that and why we should think twice about it. It's also a book about the nature of consciousness itself. So it's saying there's more to this than just the experience. There's the expansion of awareness that we all get from hearing these stories and understanding what these medicines are doing to us.
They're keys opening a doorway. Now, in some cases, is it to, like a near-death experience, is it to help ease our passing? Or are they genuinely standing on the threshold of this life and the next? I spoke to a number of people that said most definitely they were. And I think two or three of them, I can't remember exactly, were describing the near-death experience to me that they experienced, but they hadn't heard of the NDE. They didn't know it was a thing. So it's not like, oh, I came up with this idea. It was like, they're telling me the same sort of things. The beautiful countryside, the meetings with dead relatives, the reviews of past lives, of your life, and so on and so forth, so many similarities. And yet they didn't have the first clue that there was such a thing as a near-death experience. I did a phone-in show the other day, and all the people called in, seven actually, every one of them had been in a coma, and none of them had ever spoken to another coma survivor about their experiences. None of them had had a proper explanation, any explanation from hospital. The best one of them got was, oh, you have a very vivid imagination. It felt to me that everything I was saying in this book to people this directly concerns was coming as an utter and utter shock to them. And it's ridiculous that it's taken a journalist and a PI right to do a doctor's job and explain to people coming out of a procedure that shouldn't even be happening, that this is what has happened to you and this is what's going to happen to you down the line.
This is why journalists and PIs are so important. Because you have the time to research, to back it up, to go and connect the dots that a doctor who's going day to day and just trying to keep afloat with this kind of event that we had with COVID is just hoping to see a light at the end of the tunnel and recovery in some way. With this, you're able to connect the dots and say, okay, and this is how we can improve for the next go around.
Yeah, that's it, Wendy. Yeah. In a nutshell, yeah.
Okay, so you're not going to write book two. What's next? Because you guys are a dynamic duo.
No, No, I can't imagine next. Well, funny enough, okay, one thing that we might do is that B was a PI. Before that, she was an aromatherapist, and we moved to France a few years ago. She stopped doing the PI thing, and she's an aromatherapist again, and she's a major practitioner in yoga. And she went to Chiang Mai, northern Thailand, not so long ago, and studied the art of Thai massage. And what she's come up with is a form of assisted yoga, which would work perfectly for people in intensive care unit who are not getting the mobility they need. Amongst her patients, she's got somebody who relies on a hoist to get out of bed and into a chair. She's got another patient whose next birthday, it should be 101. And the joy she's bringing to her, moving her limbs, her joints, where she wouldn't ordinarily move them in such a gentle way. And there's a massive lesson to be learned there for how to treat patients in critical care. Because again, it's the human contact. Mm-hmm. And while this is happening, he's talking to them, they're talking to me. And it just lifts your day to have something like that. And it wouldn't take a lot to introduce this into critical care. When some hospitals pre-COVID had spent money on physical therapists in critical care, they discovered that patients were staying there a lot less time. They were leaving in infinitely better condition. And overall, whatever they paid for the therapist, they were getting back, and more so in savings, because everything about intensive care is expensive. And if you get people to leave comfortably as soon as possible, you are saving money. And to introduce something that he's doing, which given that a large part of her research has been looking at the damage immobility causes people, that there's so much more to be learned, so much more to be learned. This, I'd like to think, is the starting point for others to now examine, you know, debrief coma survivors if you want to understand consciousness, because they're going to levels no one has explored before. And you've got eyewitnesses, and take it from there.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I appreciate your time and the book available, Coma, Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious, has a lot that we can all learn from. It's just, I'm glad you did all the work.
Yeah, as I say, I feel really exhausted. You know, statistically, this could happen to any one of us, absolutely any one of us. And with current medical practice, if you wound up in an intensive care unit with whatever, the chances are they would knock you out to coma levels. So this could easily happen to any one of us. So we actually need to be alert. And once, you know, the knowledge in this book becomes general knowledge, only then will change come about. And it's down to the individuals to spread the word of that change. If you've been in a coma, you've been damaged. Tell the world. And if you can't get your family to understand what you've been through, get them to read the book, because the book will explain for you.
Coma and Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. Website, alanpierce.com. Links are in the description for the show. Thanks for listening.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.